be laboratory diagnosis in the HIV infected. We've heard this week about a whole range of new diagnostics, but unfortunately these aren't available today to address this problem. So what we will look at this morning are available tools that can help us meet this challenge. We have six speakers this morning, each to talk for only 15 minutes. So we will ask the speakers to address the audience and then we'll take some questions at the end of the session. So I'd firstly like to introduce my co-coordinator, Dr. Sarah Anego from Cameroon.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I will first of all want to thank, I would like to thank the organizers to have invited me. It is a great pleasure for me to be here this morning and taking part on the reflection about the challenge of TB laboratory diagnosis in the HIV infected. During my speech, I will endeavor to throw more light in the issue of the use of bleach concentration of the sputum and the improvement of the sensitivity of smear microscopy in HIV-positive patients. More have been already said about the immense burden of tuberculosis on death cause, so I will directly focus my speech by emphasizing on the problem of the sensitivity of smear microscopy. The low sensitivity of direct smear with Zinnelson staining is well known and have been reported from ages, particularly when used in field condition of national tuberculosis program. The variable range is about from 20% to 60%. This old technique, which is more than one century, remains the main tool of the TB diagnosis, particularly in low-income countries and in middle-income countries, where 95% of cases and 98% of deaths occur. It remains the most important tool because it is simple, rapid, cheap, widely applicable, and it is highly specific for Mycobacterium tuberculosis in TB endemic countries. Many factors, the sensitivity of Zinnelson may vary depending on many factors. All factors are related to the quality of the laboratory management. For example, the sample collection. Is the quantity enough? Is the quality adequate? And this quality is related to the fact that patients are well explained for the reason of sputum collection. There are also many technical aspects which can influence the sensitivity, the respect of standard procedure for smear preparation and staining. This includes the quality of reagent, also the quality of microscope. The person carrying out the test is well motivated, well trained, and also the time required for smear reading is also an important element. The longer you read the slide, the most likely is it to find Acinetobacter bacilli. Another important aspect, which has huge impact in the value of diagnosis, is the co-infection with HIV. Actually, TB is the commonest HIV-related disease, and the load bacilli is disproportionately higher in HIV-positive patients than in HIV-negative patients. This consequently makes TB harder to diagnose in HIV-positive patients. This sensitivity, which was already low, was then further reduced by the co-infection with HIV. This highlights the necessity to have a test which can improve the sensitivity, particularly in HIV-positive patients. Different methods have been proposed to improve this sensitivity. And different research have proposed the use of different chemicals, East bottom smear is liquefied with chemicals and concentrate by centrifugation or sedimentation. It could improve the sensitivity of the test. But none of these chemicals was then included in the standard procedure. The widely tested one is the sodium chloride, known as bleach household, to relevant systematic review in the improvement of the use of sodium chloride by the most recent one and complete by Stengart and collaborator, published in October 2006 in Lancet Infectious Diseases. There are many advantages for the household use of bleach. It is cheap, readily available, almost available everywhere. And the use of bleach also reduces biohazard associated with the smear preparation. But the sensitivity gain report varies tremendously between less than 0% to more than 100%. And there are few studies which have considered the sensitivity by HIV infected. Since the use of bleach concentration could turn smear classified and classified scanty into positive smear, and the proportion of scanty is more frequent found in HIV positive, this argue of the addition of bleach in the diagnosis of TB of HIV positive patient. And raise the question, does bleach concentration method improve the sensitivity of smear microscopy in the HIV infected? We have addressed this issue in Cameroon, in our country, which is high prevalence for co-infection of TB and HIV. Study was conducted in the diagnosis center of Hôpital Jama Hospital, which is the reference hospital for National Tuberculosis Program, and also in the Mycobacterial Laboratories Pasteur Institute, which acts as a national reference laboratory for National Tuberculosis Program. Since there are many patients which attend in attending diagnostic center in Hospital Jamo, the 10 morning consecutive patients without age and sex consideration were included in this study, without considering volume. One specimen of morning sputum were collected per suspect. And finally, 1,000 sputum from as many suspects sent and mycobacterial laboratory, also with the Zinnisen result of Jamo Diagnostic Center. This study was funded by USAID. Our aim was to compare the proportion of positive between the direct and concentrate smear by Zinnisen and also by fluorescence. Also to compare the increase of sensitivity between non-infected and infected HIV patients. To compare the result obtained in the diagnostic center with Zinnisen and the reference laboratory, because some discrepancies reported are sometimes related to the low reading slide and the study. For each sputum, the sputum was screened anonymously and with the ORACQUICK test for the HIV antibodies. Two direct smear was done, and the remaining sputum was split in two, and after processing with bleach, two smear were also done. One direct smear and one concentrate smear was colored by Zinnisen and also by Oramine. The remaining sputum were processed for culture in conventional LG medium, was considered in this study a reference method. Readings were made by two technicians and was blinded. HIV status was hidden. The two direct smear and the direct smear and process smear were read separately, and the result interpreted independently of the culture. 44% of patients were male, were men, and 46% were women. 45% were HIV positive, and 44% were positive culture for Mycobacterium tuberculosis. On those positive for Mycobacterium tuberculosis, 43% were also HIV positive. Okay, if we look in this board, we compare the sensitivity of the test before with direct Ziel-Nielsen and after the use of bleach. With the direct Ziel-Nielsen, the sensitivity is about 66%. When we add bleach, there is a significant increase to 63%. On the sputum treated with bleach, increased Ziel-Nielsen sensitivity significantly. If we consider the test by HIV status, we see that the sensitivity in Ziel-Nielsen, in direct Ziel-Nielsen, is low in HIV-positive patients than in HIV-negative patients. When we add bleach, there is significant increase in sensitivity also in HIV-negative patients, even if it is higher in HIV positive. The significant increased proportion of positive tests with bleach in HIV is significant in HIV positive as well as in HIV negative compared to direct Ziel-Nielsen. Okay, the sensitivity of smear microscopy is low in HIV positive patient, and in HIV negative patient, positive patient, the sensibility gain is more than in HIV negative patient, but the two are modest and the two remain modest. And the Sconti proportion is higher in Ziel-Nielsen than in when we add the bleach, but there is no difference between HIV positive patient and HIV negative patient. Same results were found with fluorescence. And there were no difference between fluorescence and Ziel-Nielsen test. So we can conclude that bleach processing increases the sensitivity of HIV positive compared with direct microscopy. But in our study, this increase is modest. The workload what we use bleach is high, but the time spent in reading slides is reduced. The main limit could be the fact that we haven't considered the volume and the quality of sputum collected. So with reference to the systematic review of Stengard and collaborator, we can also recommend that other studies have to be conducted to determine the appropriate use of sputum processing method. This should be in different steps. First, to evaluate the different processing methods under control condition, followed by blended multicenter studies in setting of high and low HIV prevalence. This will confirm the performance of the process method in setting and determine case funding, cost load, workload, and also programmatic impact. But this cannot be before doing this, it is necessary to consider the quality management of laboratory to improve the reliability of diagnosis. This quality management is a main important point before evaluate the feasibility of the study. It is important to also consider the different factors which can also influence the sensitivity of Ziel-Nielsen test, as the quality of the sputum, sample collection, and so on. Just after that, we will be able to give a direct answer to the question, does bleach concentration method improve the sensitivity of smear microscopy? Thank you.
If we could ask Professor Richard Abancik.
Good morning. It's on the left, I believe. Double click the left. Right? No.
Just need to wait for you.
Wonderful. You see, it goes. When in problems, look for a lady.
If you want to go back to do
this. Yeah. Fine. Dear chairpersons, first of all, I would like to thank for giving me this honor and pleasure to speak today before you. Now, I'd like, my dear acid fast friends, I'd like first to show the tremendous importance of case finding in our work. I admit that this is a mathematical model, and as such, it is subject to some problems. Nonetheless, look please at this example from Southeast Asia, where it clearly is shown that with the present case detection rate, which in Southeast Asia for 2004 and beginning 2005 was 42%, we may clearly see that reduction of chemotherapy from 6 to 4 months, this is the gray line, would definitely decrease the projected incidence in the future of tuberculosis. But what's shown by the red arrow, if we would increase substantially case detection, we would get much more decreased incidence in the future. So this is not so clearly shown in the second part, in the lower part. We may see that with 70%, which is the target we put ourselves, we have more or less decreased incidence of tuberculosis worldwide, or in this case for Southeast Asia, but we may infer from this the tremendous importance of increasing as much and as soon as possible the case detection. Now I'd like to draw attention to this paper. I think it's quite new, and it shows definitely that the output, what, or discharge better, of acid-fast bacilli by HIV-positive people seems to be considerably lower than with HIV-negative people, which is quite clearly shown by this. And this proportions. Now, there is, Sarah already mentioned this paper, fluorescence microscopy was in this overview on average 10% more sensitive. And of course, the results or FMRED fluorescence microscopy reading needed considerably less time than it did practically for Zier-Nielsen. I would like to draw attention to one point. It's a very good paper, very old, well, it's relative, but nonetheless, it shows quite clearly, and these are the yellow marked numbers here, that the strengths of the fluorescence microscopy seems to be in detecting much more than Zier-Nielsen what we call a rather, perhaps in an inappropriate way, scanties. So this is where fluorescence microscopy might give us better results than Zier-Nielsen, and it is in good correlation with the first slide I showed with the decreased load of mycobacteria and sputum on HIV-positive people. So improving specimen quality, facilitating collection, homogenization and concentration, Sarah already mentioned it in her excellent presentation, improving staining for fluorescence microscopy could be some of the channels or the ways for the future, but particularly changing fluorescence microscopy technology, which I won't go into detail, but there are already on the market today, I believe, three possible variants to fluorescent microscopy, which do no more use the usual bulbs or lamps, which are extremely expensive, but instead they are working with LED bulbs, and these are cheap, and they don't need dark rooms and such things. But we must start always with the specimen. I want to draw our attention now to this very simple, recently published study, how the instruction, proper instruction of the TB suspect increases dramatically the output of the sputum smear microscopy. There is no importance whether it's Zier-Nielsen or whether fluorescence. Incidentally, there was yesterday, this is a setting in Indonesia, there was yesterday a poster from Pakistan on the same issue, and again, that was in for Pakistani ladies specifically, and it was shown that it again was dramatically increased the positivity rates in the case that people were given proper instruction how to produce sputum. So this is one of the very important points I would like to stress. Now, this is from my own experience from my beloved Thailand, a country which I like very much. And there, in one hospital, they just make this sort of little housing. There's no roof on this house. Because in some parts of the world, people definitely dislike to spit in public. So we have to respect this. And for this, they constructed such a device. And I think it's working, as I've been told, and I also seen the results in this hospital. And it works in a very good way. So I want just to show that we have a lot of possibility of improvement in this area of our work. Now, Sara already mentioned this. I would like to show, this is just taken from the publication, it's again a homogenization and concentration by household bleach. And it seems that this is Ilnielsen, at least when one looks at these photos, the morphology or definitely the bacilli are better seen in the sediment processed by household bleach. This is the paper which is where the pictures are taken from. And they went even so far that the conventional approach, spot early morning spot, identified 51% of the PTB cases, and in comparison, a single bleach digested smear identified 50%. So seems to be a very good idea. There is a lot of other ideas. For instance, there are almost forgotten papers speaking about increasing the yield of fluorescence microscopy by staining at 37 degrees. This was now repeated in India in 2003, and again there was some additional yield in positive results. I want to stress that both papers they used 37 degrees because they are a mycobacteriology lab, and of course they have a thermostat, so they put it there. But nobody says that it must be 37 degrees. It might be 40 degrees, or might be 50 degrees, or might be even steaming like the Ilnielsen. We don't know. So there is some place for applied research in this field. So, incidentally, another possibility, which is which was discussed in India, is the use of salbutamol. There are two papers in Indian Journal of Tuberculosis which are free access on the internet in the last years, where people were given salbutamol to produce better sputum. If this really would be confirmed, and if it really works, then it would be a rather simple method to induce better sputum for our purposes. So that would be the advantages of fluorescence microscopy used on the large scale, which are, of course, very well known to all of us. The problems is that, speaking about peripheral laboratories, we definitely speak about the multipurpose microscope, because no, or almost no, laboratory in the periphery is doing only AFB microscopy, but they are doing parasitology, they are doing malaria, they are doing a lot of other things. So in other words, they need a light microscope possibility also. A very heavy problem is that we do not have agreed external quality assurance for fluorescence microscopy. As a matter of fact, we do not know, and I want to stress this, we do not have solid data on the duration for how long we can keep, for instance, an auramine solution. We do not know and don't have solid data on how long a fluorescent smear positive will keep its positivity to be rechecked without restaining. We don't know this solidly. I tried to contact Ron Smithwick, which is one of the best experts in this area, for former CDC. Unfortunately, I didn't get the answer from him before this Congress. So I would like to stress that we have in this field very many possibilities for further small applied research. We should use it. Thank you very much for your attention.
The next speaker is Armand Van Den from Union and Mycobacteriology Unit Institute of Tropical Medicine in Belgium. He will speak on improving the sensitivity and efficiency of AFB microscopy. Should start by improving the testing strategy.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. The subject, in fact, is deviating a bit from what we are usually looking for, but I think it's worth it because, well, we always say microscopy is the most appropriate diagnostic tool for TB control in high-burden countries, and I'm not the one who is going to contradict that. But on the other hand, there is widespread dissatisfaction because, especially in recent years, people always say the sensitivity is so bad, that it's tedious, it is cumbersome. And we know already that improving sensitivity is not that easy. We have tried a number of things, and you have heard now just the bleach method for HIV positives, fluorescence microscopy, but these are often not miracle solutions. There have been publications of 100% and more gain, but these have not been confirmed, unfortunately. So I think there is certainly, and maybe first of all, a need to streamline its use. So that means the guidelines that we, WHO, the Union, are making, I think we should have a critical look at these. And okay, it's not the first time that this is being said. We could start by the usual strategy. Everybody knows that spot, morning spot. In fact, where does this come from? This is just a compromise. This is from the old days in India in the 60s, where there was a very much decentralized, specialized TB service, and people had to travel from very far away to reach there, and these studies that were done, in fact, they knew that this was not the best for yield, but just for patient friendliness, not to lose the patients. This was finally the strategy that was proposed. Now, on the other hand, we know from another recent review, not yet published, but by the group of Madurai Pai, that more than 50 studies, and however they looked at it, the yield, the additional yield over the first two sputa, the third sputum, only brought like 2-3%. And that stratifying HIV positive, negative, whatever, and in a wide variety of settings and in a wide variety of study designs. And you could say, okay, this is maybe not reliable because there is so much variations between these studies, they are not directly comparable. On the other hand, you could say, yes, but this is reality. If we look at it in so many different settings and we always come back to that same yield of only 2-3%, a lot of things may have gone wrong, and I think all of us supervisors, consultants, we know very well visiting laboratories that there may be three results in that lab register, but that in many places only one or two are really examined. But then what does it mean? It means that our strategy is not appropriate, I'm afraid. And so, okay, Well, this is just another example from a table that I like to show, and this is more recent studies. Older studies, in fact, the original where the strategy was based upon is the first one, Andrews, and they had 3% also as the incremental yield of the third, and in recent years, well, studies with only 1% additional yield. And, okay, then there is maybe the problem that some people don't really realize what this means. And decision makers, I don't think there are many decision makers who have looked at 20 smears in a row. They don't know what this means. They say, okay, we have the people and they just have to do it. Yeah, it's very easy to say that, but if you start to make the calculation, it means that for at a 10% average positivity rate, it means that 900 tests have to be done to get these last three cases. 900 tests, that is 2 to 3 months full-time work of a technician. I cannot call that cost-effective or efficient. And at the other hand, this is probably having serious adverse effect on quality, because we know, like from rechecking exercises where we compare performance of the controllers with the people in the peripheral centers, we know very well that if we start to overload controllers, and that is very quickly done, their results are less reliable than the ones than those of the ones in the centers. So overload is absolutely detrimental to quality, and it's happening much faster than people think. Okay, then people say, yeah, but if we reduce the number of sputa, we are going to lose cases. I think that's never shown, because all these studies on the yield of the third smear have been done in settings where three sputa were examined, and from that, the yield of the third was examined. It has never been shown that two sputa in a real-life situation where the strategy of two sputa was compared with a strategy of three sputa. It has only been done in one study, and that was a historical comparison in Malawi, and in fact, these people had the same case detection finally, just going for two compared to going for three sputa. But it was historical, so not the ideal study, of course. In fact, it's not excluded that a strategy based on two sputa could even bring more positives. Nobody has shown that this is not happening, it's not possible, because of possibly better quality of examination. And alternative strategies are possible, like two morning sputa instead of spot morning spot, two smears even from the same morning sputum. And this is something I came upon recently, because looking at some studies, not in this strategy studies, but studies comparing different techniques and on duplicate smears from the same specimen, and then I was always amazed to see so much difference between the different smears done by different methods, but that in fact, what is shown here, the ones that were positive with the least sensitive technique, so it was the worst technique in fact, but still, there was a certain percentage of positives which was detected by these least sensitive techniques, which had not been detected from the same sputum with the better technique. So it means even repeating a smear from the same sputum, on the average 11%, which is more than 3% of the third sputum. And that could be very convenient for a patient also, doing two smears from the same sputum. And then we have said already morning sputum, because we know there is a big difference between spot and morning sputa. Professor Urbancic has reviewed a number of studies long time ago, 10 to 100%. In Bangladesh, when we had this one study, we found that the morning sputa increased the yield by 10% compared to the spot sputa. And in three morning sputum, well, this strategy where they brought three morning sputa at the same time to the center, already 94% of positives were detected on the first. And I think that is very important, because honestly, I believe that if the first sputum is negative, that many technicians are not looking closely anymore at the second and the third. So I really would like that the first sputum is a good sputum, is the best sputum possible. And other speakers have emphasized that the quality of the sputum and how you explain to the patients and so on is very, very, very important. So, two morning samples, if we do that, is the patient returning? In the Bangladesh study that I refer to, 10% were not returning. That's a problem, of course. But when we looked further into this, because we had some reserve sputa for them, 1.5% only were positive. And when we looked, when we followed up these cases, they refused, in fact, to be treated. They had just gone to private or something like that. And finally, the effect was that more patients were put on treatment using a strategy with morning sputa, even when it took a bit more time for the patients to get the results. Okay, is that kind of strategy incompatible with increased detection? Our target these days, more and more cases to be detected. I don't think so, because you have to see this as a screening, as a first screening strategy. Do we do three or do we do two? Sputa, indiscriminately, everybody has to do that. But you can still go on. There is still the rule that if patients are negative on the first series, they come back, you can again take another series of sputa, and this is going to be, of course, much more efficient. Concentrate your efforts on patients who, by clinical screening, seem to be more suspect of TB, and do more sputa for that. And in this regard, the Zimbabwe study by the group of Liz Corbett of last year, I like that very much. They did something like that, they got, in fact, out-of-culture positives, good cultures, and then smears, and then HIV-positive, HIV-negative, they got very high proportion detected by smear, and almost the same in the HIV-positive as in the HIV-negative. It must be said they used concentration method and they used fluorescence for that. And then again, looking closer at their data, so this was repeated series of three sputa, but the third sputum in each of these series was much less rewarding, but then the patient came back 3 weeks later, and again, they had much higher detection rates in that next series. And so this is something that could be built into a strategy. Now, another objection against a two-sputum strategy that has been raised is, yes, but our definition of a positive case, a smear-positive case, requires two positive sputa. Two positive results. Now, I don't think that excludes that we can use a screening strategy based on two sputa, because if only one is positive, okay, just ask for an additional one and try to confirm that positive sputum. And the other point is that really justified and useful? Where on which rationale is this rule based that we should have two positives before declaring a smear positive case? What does it bring along for delays in treatment, early mortality, early default, and for which gain? And okay, looking at that a bit closer, why is the rule, for instance, two positive smears but only one positive culture is enough to define a case? I don't see the reason, because in high prevalence countries, culture is probably less specific than smear for the detection of ARB, and they are almost always TB there, because all the laboratory people here know that the carryover, the cross-contamination that you get in culture is in the order of 3 to 5%. In so many settings, we don't get that from smear. Smear false positives is in good people, good microscope, bit of training and so on, is less than 1% for clear-cut positives, while on the other hand, misidentification of specimens, sure, but that is the same for smears, microscopy smears or cultures. So I don't see why this discrimination of smears compared to cultures. And at the same time, we allow that by X-ray so many false diagnoses happen. We know that. So why are we making it so difficult for microscopy to avoid maybe 1% of false positives? When we looked at it in a Bangladesh study, the ones that were not confirmed by further positive smears, it was in fact less than 1%, so the positive predictive value over the first positive smear was over 99%. I think that's too high to make problems. Okay, another question about the term scanty or the 1 to 9 AFB in 100 fields, and you know that 10 AFB in 100 fields is our cutoff to declare a clear-cut positive. And in fact, that shouldn't be a problem, but from experience we see that in so many countries all kinds of funny things happen, and quite regularly I see that these results are changed into negative. Because, yeah, people are not allowed to register these patients as positive cases. It should be confirmed by further smears. Doctors get annoyed, and technicians, they tend to hide these results, change them, and whatever. So, in fact, why? In fact, the correlation with culture is good already for much lower numbers of AFBs. Studies in India, studies in Algeria, 3 to 4 AFB was enough to have a very good correlation with culture. The Cubica, the well-known Cubica multicenter study, even just only 1 in 100, and that was the same for fluorescence as for Seale-Nielsen microscopy. And so when we did a study like that, in fact, we found that from the 1 in 100 and 2 in 100 lead results, a small proportion could not be confirmed by further positive smears in the next sputa that were taken from the same patients, like 15-20% of those results, but when it came to 3 and 4 and 5, all of them had successively, had after that, almost always positive further smears. So they were confirmed by further smears in the same series. And in fact, this group is not so low in that study. It was like 10% of total patients who had AFB in the sputum. So I think it's worthwhile to reconsider also the cutoff, the threshold that we set for positivity in smears. I think it could be lower. It could be like 1 in 100, like it is done in industrialized countries where people are not seeing more positives and where I don't think they are supposed to be more experienced. Okay, then finally something about fluorescence microscopy. And the rule there is that we should confirm a positive fluorescence result by overstaining it with Seale-Nielsen and finding again the AFB with a normal microscope. Again, I don't know if this has been decided upon from studies, but certainly it undoes a lot of the advantages of fluorescence microscopy. It's supposed to be less work, but then again you give them more work by doing this, and you must, and Professor Urbancic has stressed the low positive or the scanty smears is exactly what you gain with your fluorescence microscopy, but these are also the ones that are very difficult to reconfirm. The reproducibility in that range is low. So in fact, it's very often the case that they cannot be found again in Seale-Nielsen, and then we know from people in industrialized countries where there was systematic culture also that a lot of these are later on found to be culture positives. Not always, but so this rule is also a bit difficult, and probably it's better to rely on internal controls at least to be sure that we avoid systematic errors, that all positives would be false by using internal controls. But, well, what we could propose is to confirm fluorescence at a higher magnification, for instance. So this is a low magnification fluorescence. It's quite difficult to be sure sometimes, and then if you go to this is 1,000 times magnification, you can see the typical morphology of the TB bacilli much better. And is that not good enough to be reasonably sure that we have a positive? Okay, so to conclude, sensitivity of AFB microscopy depends on a lot of things, and one of them is also the quality and the number of sputa, then the reading, the number of fields that we read, and so on. So we need, of course, to do enough. On the other hand, we know there is the human factor, and in many studies, the human factor has been found to be the most important one for the final quality of the examination. And then I know, and I think others also have seen that, motivation, but also fatigue. It's very tiresome to do this examination. And so we should be careful. We should find balance between the number of sputa, the number of fields that we want to be examined in our guidelines versus the quality that we can expect. And we must, for instance, make a distinction between first line indiscriminate screening guideline, not exaggerate there, and like I said, maybe further serious in suspects that we seem to be not improving on symptomatic therapy. We must take into account the number of sputa, the type of sputa also, and patient friendliness. And so I think we should have more research, but not more research again on what is the yield of the third sputum in the way it was done, but rather comparing the spot morning spot classical strategy with possible alternatives, like two morning sputa delivered together, like two smears from even the same single morning sputum, like pooling morning sputa and putting a concentration technique on that and making only one smear out of that and just see what it brings. And there may still be other possibilities, I don't know. Okay, that's it.
Integrated Laboratory Quality Assurance for TB and HIV by John Riddlehoff of Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, Matokla.
Okay. This is certainly a very broad topic, and so what I'm going to try to do this morning is really touch on a few items and actually spend a little more time with the HIV because many of the people here have the knowledge of the TB. Now, first of all, when we talk about laboratory quality assurance, I think more and more we use that word because people understand that, but we've also discussed yesterday, we need to start promoting more of the modern terminology. It's not just quality control, quality assurance. It's actually, and I should have had here, quality management systems is more of the international terminology. That's more holistic. It includes the whole system. It includes all of the different quality system essentials, whether that be the CLSI framework or the ISO. If we think about integration, what we're really talking about, in many cases, it's the same personnel. They may have shared equipment, same facilities and safeties. Now, this is one that would take a lot more time to go into. How do we really integrate this, especially at the clinic level? And today, what I am going to focus on a little bit more is really the EQA. And this one here, hopefully many people have seen and are well acquainted with. This has been here for years. And I'm sorry if this is, I'm not going to focus as much on this. The question would be, have we really seen these new guidelines that came out in January? Sometimes we don't market these as well. These are guidelines for assuring the accuracy and reliability of HIV rapid testing. And they look at really the whole quality system, but it also includes issues on the EQA. And so what I'm going to do is go over these and maybe do a little bit compare and contrast with the TB guidelines, the microscopy guidelines. One of the first ones is looking at organization. We can't just get down into the details. How is this structured? And in fact, that's going to be one of the biggest barriers, I think, for integrating quality assurance and making sure it's available for both tests. This is one that we do promote. Have a national quality system, a national office for quality assurance. It can't just be a part-time job for each different institution and national reference laboratory. You should have a national quality assurance manager. And this is another one that we'll come back to. Have a multi-sectorial working team that avoids just vertical assessments. Yes, we know sometimes you can only visit and look at the TB, but that is not always helpful if they're performing multiple tests in those locations. And extend the system to all tiers. And this is the barrier right now. I think it's very incomplete. It varies by country of how far down. We've heard this week how far down has EQA extended, how far has that been implemented for AFP microscopy. I think it's even more difficult for HIV testing, and I am emphasizing some of the rapid tests. It's a generalization, but I think something that we have to look at. If we do look at some of the standard laboratory structure, this is also one that I think it has been more complete in terms of rolling out EQA and implementing that for AFB microscopy. If we're going to talk about integrating HIV testing and TB, we have to recognize where are these being performed. And very often you may have the district laboratory will perform HIV testing, but the bulk of HIV testing is being performed in these ancillary sites, VCT sites. You may have, I would give an example of South Africa, where the NHLS system has roughly around 250 laboratories within that system. There's about 3,000 to 4,000 HIV rapid test sites that are outside of that system. And there's many more examples. So how do we access that? Do the health centers actually, are they connected to the structured laboratory system? And very often, therefore, the guidance comes from national programs and not through right now. That this is in a state of flux, but this is something I think we just have to recognize as a barrier and something to work on. For the HIV, the model followed the microscopy EQA, emphasizing really three components: the on-site monitoring or assessment. We're calling this for the rapid test retesting, not rechecking, but they're the same concept there. And proficiency testing, which we also call panel testing within HIV. This is some of the current practice for mostly the HIV rapid tests. Earlier programs relied heavily on retesting. I think a lot of the USAID was one of the best in moving this out to sites, having structured programs. Very often, this also depends on whether you have a venous sample or whether you're just taking a finger stick or finger prick for some of the rapid tests. In doing so, you may have serum available or you have dried blood spots to do retesting. You know, the formula's been 10%. However, in doing so, there's delays. The result may come back 3 to 4 months later. Now, that could be the same for TB, but what does that mean? And very often, can you actually separate out errors in the retesting process versus documenting that that was actually an error in the original patient testing? And in fact, many of the national reference labs that started these programs overwhelmed. They're having freezers full of specimens. They're behind at the same time that you're trying to roll out and extend the number of testing sites. So I think we have to look at this and also consider the differences in the types of testing, the subjectivity and diligence for microscopy versus these single unit disposable tests for HIV rapid tests that are used in algorithm. It may be one for a negative, but it has to be at least two for a positive. So on-site monitoring varies by country. There is some capacity for proficiency testing, and I know this is changing, but as a generalization, there's often a lack of national oversight, analysis, and feedback for a lot of these HIV rapid test sites. I'm sorry, this will be a little bit of a tease. I know we like to look at models, but within the retesting for HIV, we also looked at doing something that had more of a statistical basis, which is also used for the lot quality assurance for rechecking, but with some differences. Once again, it's the low-volume sites are not testing enough specimens to give themselves a really accurate picture testing, and the high-volume sites are testing too many specimens. You don't need to do that if you use statistics. This is looking at 95% confidence in determining whether you want to detect 1% error or 5%, and then you have to look at the feasibilities of using these kind of schemes. But it's somewhat complex. Once again, I don't know that this is the best way to go. Let's remember the differences also in looking at issues of retesting. As we said, for the AFB microscopy, it's issues of motivations, diligence, the preparation, the staining, the interpretation, whereas you do have to have the training, you have to perform the test correctly, but very often the performance comes down to the quality of the manufacturer's device too. And once again, they're used in algorithms. So you're getting a result from perhaps two tests and not just one test. So, okay. So some of the recommendations there is the same as AFB microscopy, place the emphasis on the on-site assessment. You know, visit the folks. And you can look at it from a different perspective. This is not just a performance issue. These are folks out in these settings that on a day-to-day basis are providing people, informing them of their HIV status. They need this kind of support. They want that kind of support to know that they're doing the right thing. Look at all aspects of the quality systems. Here's the similarities with the AFB. Look at all your records, storage, inventories. Observe the testing especially. And very often, why don't you just bring in some proficiency testing samples? Can they perform those correctly? Observe them with some of the patients. That's probably the most important thing as opposed to looking at a lot of the schemes. Now, quickly, I want to just go through a few national programs and look at this issue. And this is a quick one. Zimbabwe is one that has developed a parastatal organization, ZINQOP, the Zimbabwe National Quality Assurance Program. And this is integrated. They do sample prep. A lot of this is EQA-based, but they do workshops, develop laboratory standards, and so on. They do a lot with sample distribution. They may get samples from outside of the country. They may develop their own. One important thing, we worked with them, and they've spent a lot of time, and they worked their way up to SANIS, a South African ISO-based accreditation. And this is accreditation as an EQA organization. And so this does provide a higher level of quality in your whole process. In doing so, they have a number of schemes, and this is what we have to look at. We focus in this meeting on TB, but we have to recognize there's a lot of other testing going on, and how can we support that? The limitation would be there is TB microscopy. I don't really have data on that, but they're really sending out two unstained smears. Now, we would know, and we'll discuss, that's not the optimum, but in fact, they are generating this, and they have then the capacity to expand out with this and to also look at all of these other testing services. One problem with many of the programs, and this is just looking at ELISA HIV, they also have rapid test surveys they send out, is very often they're not returned. And that's something I think we all have to address. So you send out, you make all this effort, and you don't get any results back. Here's another one with our colleagues from South Africa. Obviously, South Africa is a larger nation. If I might say, a much more sophisticated system. They have multiple organizations, but they have the National Health Laboratory System Quality Assurance Division. They have National Institute of Communicable Diseases and a large EQA unit. I don't have listed, but they do have multiple EQA programs for a variety of analytes or tests. They did adopt, using panel testing, the EQA guidelines for AFB, using 8 slides, 4 stained, 4 unstained. And this is just showing a little bit. You know, once again, although I know all of us as colleagues would see that panel testing is not the optimum, you do find problems within the system. This is looking at the number of labs and looking at any particular errors, quantification errors, false positives, and any false negatives. And this varied by survey. So they were finding problems, ones that needed to be corrected. Now, the last few slides, this is just to touch on some of the key features. They do have national quality assurance and EQA units in South Africa and Zimbabwe, and this is not present in all countries. They have laboratory auditors trained in ISO-based standards, so you do have a higher level of quality in terms of how to audit and to assess. They have PT-based EQA for TB and HIV, and it does extend down to a certain level. It needs to go farther. We know there's that limitation. In both countries, there's interest in rechecking. Right now, there's, I don't think, the capacity to do that in Zimbabwe. But to do so, you probably have to devolve responsibility to implementation to the intermediate level. This is what we've always known. You can't consolidate 100 labs sending all of their smears for rechecking to, say, one laboratory. What are some of the challenges? One for HME, many have not implemented EQA. They train people, they're sent out there, and there is no systematic monitoring and assessment. Many countries are proposing retesting because it sounds very logical. I'm not sure that I would recommend that because I think it's not always practical. It doesn't tell you a lot. You could do it maybe as sentinel sites or other, but in many cases they don't find high rates of error if you have a structured program with training and so on. And as we said, we need intermediate level for rechecking programs. And in many ways, this may be too complex for the national EQA unit. So yes, they can put together proficiency testing. This is just a quick model. This is, I think, my second to last slide here. Promote national quality assurance units, or EQA, if you want to call it that, to provide the expertise for the implementation. It combines scarce resources and it strengthens all testing. I really think the TB community has to look at what is our part in helping with HIV, because certainly in the African setting, the high HIV setting, TB control was not going to go forward without addressing HIV. But you also need a strong intermediate level to perform integrated on-site supervision. Look at all of the testing that's performed on-site. You can provide PT with samples developed at the national level. A national unit can do that. And the intermediate level can perform rechecking of smears. So just to repeat a little bit, this is my recommendations. Develop integrated QA units. They can work with HIV and TB national reference labs and other ones if they're all in different institutions, which in many countries they may be. Train for integrated supervisory visits. Implement reasonable EQA for HIV rapid test, and emphasize observing the test performance. That's the critical part. And then, although the QA units can start with PT and actually implement something, I think we all need to look at some form of rechecking by the intermediate level. And I'd like to thank these individuals in South Africa and Zimbabwe that provided some of the material and information. Thank you.
I invited Peter Wright-Smith on. He will speak on diagnosis latent tuberculosis in the HIV infected in high TB prevalence setting.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak, and it's you give me a very long title and a very big subject. So there are two specific things that I'll be focusing on today. The first is really to discuss why we should even bother with latent TB at all in high prevalence settings, given the importance of active case finding and of ensuring treatment. And the second is that I have particular experience and expertise in the new blood tests for latent tuberculosis, and so I will be reviewing the emerging data on these tests, particularly amongst the HIV infected, and discussing whether they have applicability in high endemicity settings. So, as I've said, really, the approach to TB control at high endemicity settings is primarily based on improving case detection and on ensuring adherence to treatment via DOTS and DOTS Plus. However, it is important to point out that latent TB screening and preventative treatment is recommended amongst the HIV infected as well as children, because it is clearly a group of very high risk of reactivation from latent to active tuberculosis, and because preventative treatment is well known to be very effective in doing so. And I think a slightly incidental point is that because of the risks of immune reconstitution syndrome, the knowledge of an HIV-infected person's TB status is arguably of increasing importance. That's the current situation. But looking to the future, I think it's also pretty clear that we're going to need to address latent tuberculosis in high endemicity settings as well as in low prevalence areas, because active case detection and BCG vaccination alone are not going to really reduce TB incidence below a certain threshold. And to illustrate that, Chris Dye has, from the WHO, has very kindly let me use his slides here. And they've been doing some very interesting modeling showing the expected decline in TB incidence using two variants of TB control. In this case, the current approach, which is vaccination and active case finding and treatment. And I think what this slide very clearly shows is that even with good implementation of these two situations, there will be, even by 2050, we will reach essentially a threshold below which we're not able to reduce TB incidence. And what their modelling went on to show is actually, in order to get below, to meet the Millennium Development Goals of ultimately eradicating tuberculosis, we are going to need to incorporate latent TB identification and treatment into our TB control programs, here in combination with active tuberculosis case finding, and here in combination with BCG vaccination. So I think over the much longer term, you know, there is a vision that we are going to have to address latent TB infection around the world. And in particular, to come back to the point about HIV, why focus on HIV? Well, I think the combination of the high risk of reactivation and the efficacy of chemoprophylaxis makes identifying and treating latent tuberculosis, particularly amongst the HIV infected, very cost effective compared to, for example, those who are not HIV infected. And you can see that actually when compared against other forms of TB control, actually doing this is extremely cost effective compared to the other interventions that we currently use. Unfortunately, however, systematic attempts to do this are hampered by the many deficiencies of the test that we have at the moment that's in widespread use, and that's the tuberculin skin test. Clearly, we all know about the problems with non-returns, the low specificity, but I think here I specifically want to talk on the issue that most affects those in the HIV community, and that's the low sensitivity of the skin test. And HIV is arguably a special case because of the extent and singularity of the immunosuppression. And we know that the skin test sensitivity falls dramatically, clearly depending on the cutoff used and the stage of disease in the HIV infected. And this falling sensitivity is also allied to increasing rates of anergy, the inability essentially to produce any kind of induration. And both of those phenomena are significantly related to CD4 count and can be extreme in CD4 counts below 200 cells per microliter. And in response to this, clearly a number of people have attempted to see whether the sensitivity of the skin test can be improved by reducing the cutoff. And that strategy really relies on anergy being a gradual loss of the delayed type hypersensitivity reaction with CD4 count and immunosuppression, rather than just a switch off of the ability to produce an induration at a certain level of immunosuppression. And I think some newer work from Frank Koblenz and his collaborators have suggested actually that it is really a switch off, and below a certain level of immunosuppression, you just cannot get any kind of skin test response at all. And therefore, reducing the skin test cutoff is of marginal utility in increasing the sensitivity of the skin test amongst the HIV infected. Recently, and two new tests for the diagnosis of latent TB infection have been launched and are being used in low-incidence countries now. There are two such tests, sometimes also called interferon gamma tests. They are T-spot TB, which is based on an ELISpot method, and QuantiFERON Gold, based on an ELISA method. And notwithstanding the fact that these two techniques use different technologies, they ultimately rely on the same principle, and that is to challenge the cellular immune response of an individual with TB antigens and then measure whether there's any cellular immune response to those antigens. And if there is one, that indicates the presence of TB infection. And you can see this table here taken from a recent review paper. The antigens used in both of these tests are two antigens you may have heard of called ESAT6 and CFP10. Both of these antigens come from a region of the tuberculosis genome that is not shared with all BCG vaccine strains, and therefore this is one of the reasons these tests don't cross-react to BCG. And unlike the skin test, both of these tests have a positive internal control, and the purpose for this really is to assess whether the results that you're getting from an individual patient, whether your test is able to measure a valid response, whatever the immune system status of the individual, i.e. is there a situation below which the immunosuppression of the individual is too high to be able to get a discernible response. So it's almost like an anergy control. Clearly, both tests can't be boosted and don't need a return visit because they're laboratory tests. And then the only difference really between them is in the methodology and therefore the end result of the tests, T-spot measuring individual T-cells that are reacting to tuberculosis and QuantiFERON measuring the amount of interferon gamma released in response to stimulation by the antigens. So what are the potential advantages of these in the HIV-infected in high endemicity? Well, I think the first and very important one is high specificity. These tests will not cross-react to BCG because of the fact that the antigens they use, unlike period unlike PPD, does not share antigens with BCG. Also, by fortune, essentially, these antigens are also not present in most non-tuberculous mycobacteria and therefore should avoid a lot of the false positives that we see with the skin test. I should point out, though, that ESAT6 and CFP10 are present in 4 non-tuberculous mycobacteria species, and false positive results in people who are infected with these should be expected. And there has been some suggestion that these antigens might cross-react in patients infected with M. leprae, and the performance of these tests has not yet been validated in leprosy endemic regions. But notwithstanding high specificity, I think there's a great deal of excitement that these tests may potentially have higher sensitivity than the skin test, particularly in the HIV-infected, because they work on a different principle than the delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. And if they can do this, they'll be picking up patients who are missed by the skin test, but who are at very high risk of reactivation to active tuberculosis. But it is a very important question also for these tests to see whether they suffer from allergy in the same way that the skin test does. But it's clear that, at least hypothetically, a test that reduces the numbers of false positives and at the same time detects more people who have a high risk of reactivation to active TB should have a much higher positive predictive value of who will actually develop active tuberculosis. And if that proves to be the case, it will radically shift the clinical and cost-effectiveness arguments towards more widespread screening for LTBI around the world, and notwithstanding high endemicity countries. So what evidence do we have? And what I've tried to do here is summarize what is, sadly, still a very emerging area with really very little data on both of these tests in HIV and in HIV in high endemicity settings. Looking first at clinical sensitivity in active disease, because clearly in latent tuberculosis we don't have a gold standard, so it is often useful to extrapolate the performance from active tuberculosis. There have been 2 studies with QuantiFERON in that setting showing clinical sensitivities of 23 and 65% respectively, and there have been 3 studies with T-spot TB showing 81 to 90%. I think a key question, though, is whether these tests are actually more sensitive than the skin test. And there have been 2 studies on both of these tests where they have been directly compared side by side to the skin test in the same population. And at the p equals less than 0.05 level, both the QuantiFERON gold studies showed that actually this test had lower sensitivity than the skin test, and both the T-spot studies showed a higher sensitivity than the skin test. The third row here really asks a third important question: is the sensitivity of these tests dramatically affected by HIV infection itself? So this is where they're comparing cohorts of HIV infected to non-HIV infected with the same test. We clearly know the skin test is significantly affected, and I think the 2 studies with T-spot have shown that it isn't affected by HIV. I clearly think that one should recognize in all of these studies there is a trend, because clearly HIV-infected individuals are more immunosuppressed, but they don't yet reach statistical significance. With QuantiFERON gold, the jury's still a bit out. There was one saying yes and one saying no. And turning to the question of allergy stroke indeterminate rates, as I said before, both these tests have a positive control. And this essentially expresses whether these tests are capable of picking up a response from individuals with extreme immunosuppression. And where they are unable to do so, it's called an indeterminate result, which is largely equivalent to what we might consider to be allergy with the skin test. Clearly, we know the skin test can be significantly affected. There have been 3 studies with QuantiFERON. These 2 were in high endemicity settings, showing a 46% and a 19% indeterminate rate. This study was in Denmark amongst HIV patients on heart, where the overall rate was 3.4%. T-SPOT, there have been three studies showing between 0 and 3%, one of them in a high endemicity setting, which was this one, and these two in the UK. And I think there is some hope here that actually these tests are less affected by anergy than the skin test. And this is because at least early data is showing that for these tests, particularly for T-SPOT, that the actual antigen and mitogen response is largely unaffected by CD4 count, even with people with very low CD4 counts, because of the higher underlying sensitivity of these techniques compared to the DTH reaction of the skin test. And with QuantiFERON, I think that we're only seeing an effect below CD4 counts of 200, which I think is a very positive thing as well. So that's a very brief attempt to summarize the literature. And I think that the sensitivity and specificity and other advantages of the interferon gamma tests are not really in dispute. I think the key question for their applicability in HIV-infected individuals is whether they're affected by immunosuppression to the same degree as the skin test. And I think that early evidence suggests that these tests may suffer less from this phenomenon than the skin test, although that may be technology-specific, you know, ELISpot versus ELISA. And I think at the moment, of the two blood tests, T-SPOT is the only one that's shown possibly higher sensitivity than the skin test, although we should recognize that study numbers are still very small. And I think when I reviewed this data, I think one of the things that was clearly evident is that there is a substantial lack of data on these tests in latent tuberculosis, in HIV, in high endemicity settings. And therefore, we've had to extrapolate the results and findings from data either in the developed world or just amongst active TB in high endemicity settings. And clearly, a number of studies would be extremely useful, not least of which is to do the very difficult but very necessary studies to prove the positive predictive value of one of these tests being positive to the eventual development of active tuberculosis. So in conclusion, I think the identification of latent TB amongst the HIV-infected is extremely important, and it's likely to become ever more so as we move to better control and ultimately and hopefully the eventual elimination of TB globally. Attempts to do this have, however, been clearly hampered by the poor performance of the skin test in HIV-infected, and the new blood tests are showing some promise for diagnosing LTBI more reliably in HIV-infected populations. But I think that as well as substantial increases in the clinical proof of these new blood tests, there are going to be some significant other challenges to their widespread adoption, not least of which is the cost of the tests. I think if these tests are able to demonstrate a higher positive predictive value for the eventual development of active TB, they're likely to be highly cost effective, even in high endemicity settings. But that doesn't mean that that's going to be necessarily easy to get the money to pay for them in the first place, because the benefits of that will be felt years down the line. I think the second thing is both these tests require laboratory infrastructure. They're relatively complex tests, and they do require equipment. And so there's going to be a great deal of work necessary to ensure that we have a laboratory infrastructure capable of taking these tests and a logistic network capable also of getting the samples to an appropriately qualified laboratory within an adequate period of time. And I think lastly, I just want to point out that a blood test is no panacea. We're obviously very used to people not returning to receive the results of skin tests. But one should also point out that gaining blood samples from people is not a perfect science either. And in one of the field studies of these tests in South Africa recently, 17% of individuals were unable to get a blood sample from, and that's something that needs to be borne in mind. And I think I'll leave you with a further, shall I say, slightly downbeat point, which is, you know, the diagnosis of LTBI is only one half of this equation. The subsequent effective treatment of LTBI is the second most important, second equally important aspect of this. And I think it's clear that more widespread use of chemoprophylaxis in high endemicity settings presents a considerable challenge, both in terms of compliance, but also the experience of the distribution of antiretroviral drugs across sub-Saharan Africa shows us that there are a significant number of logistic and other barriers to widespread application of treatment. So just to finish, I'd like to thank a number of individuals who have helped me by giving me access to their results, and would like to point out my clear conflict of interest that I'm an employee of one of the manufacturers that make these tests. Thank you very much.
Peter, we are actually running a little bit ahead of schedule, so if
people in the audience would like to address a couple of questions to Peter. Yes.
If you get involved in extensive preventive treatments in developing countries based on a T-spot test, how do you rule out active disease among these patients and not end up with an enormous number of people who are INH resistant because you're treating active disease with INH alone?
I think that's a very, very valid question. And I think that's one of the reasons that screening using the skin test has focused primarily on children and HIV, because the rate of reactivation is so high that actually the cost benefit and the clinical cost benefit, should we say, of treatment is far outweighed by the high risk of progression to active tuberculosis. I think the second thing to say on that is that when we do these studies, my strong belief is that we will find that the traditional 10% chance per lifetime of a positive skin test resulting in active TB, that 10% will probably rise to 20 or 30% with one of these tests, because you won't be having the false positives and you will be able to detect the people who the skin test previously missed that were at very high risk of reactivation. Now, suddenly, if you've got a test that has, you know, that if you're positive to, you have a 1 in 3 chance of developing active tuberculosis, I think, again, that radically shifts the cost-effectiveness and clinical arguments towards treatment, you know, notwithstanding the side effects and the resistance challenges that that produces. And I think my third point is to say that clearly I think the embracing of these technologies for widespread screening is, to my mind, only practically going to happen when we have a more effective, shorter treatment for LTBI to go hand in hand with that. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks.
The last speaker is Karam Siddiqui from Newfield Center for International Health and Development. You have a floor.
Thank you for the invitation. I think there's a bit of contradiction in the my title of my presentation and the theme, which is TB laboratory diagnosis and the clinical and the radiological diagnosis. But I think it's probably done on purpose to be kind to the audience. If you've had enough of listening to the laboratory jargon, no disrespect to the previous speakers, it might come in handy and a bit refreshing. On a more serious note, I think it's an admittance that actually laboratory hasn't delivered for all sorts of reasons the sort of gold standard or the ultimate diagnostic tool or test to diagnose TB. And it's a bit sad, but majority of clinicians still have to rely on clinical and radiological signs to diagnose TB. I say that with a bit of credibility because before becoming a public health researcher at University of Leeds, I used to be a chest physician working in Pakistan for about 9 years. And we struggled amongst many of the clinicians to diagnose TB, mainly relying on clinical and radiological findings, with labs really not performing well and in the absence of a test that can actually give us a clear diagnosis. Okay, I would like to present some of the highlights of the review of the evidence that we've done over the last few years and the few papers that we've published. And some of these papers are lying in the front row. So at the end, if you're interested, you can pick up some of these papers to look at some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about. Just to put things into context, I think sputum microscopy, as previous speakers have said, it's only positive in about 50 to 60% of patients with pulmonary TB. And the other rapid diagnostic tools which are emerging are either under development, not cost-effective, or not widely available. And in patients with HIV infection, smear negative TB has a particularly poor prognosis. And it is possible that delay in the diagnosis of smear negative TB actually causes increased mortality in that group. Now, the dilemma is that in patients with HIV and TB, with negative smears, they also have non-specific symptoms and a broad range of differential diagnoses, such as pneumocystis, pneumoniae, and bacterial and fungal infections. One of the problems of the algorithms for diagnosing TB is actually TB is a relatively rare diagnosis in patients who are coughing with 2 or more weeks. There are lots of other diagnoses which we tend not to consider when we actually develop those guidelines and algorithms. So, and obviously the dilemma is that in the absence of any simple investigations or rapid diagnostic tests, clinicians like myself working in developing countries have to rely on the clinical and radiological tests. And so far, from the review that we've done, various algorithms, scoring systems and tools have been developed, but I don't think any of those are reliable enough for people to put their money on it. This case definition was part of the International Standards for Tuberculosis Care, which was presented last year at this conference. And I don't need to repeat it. I think you can see it by yourself, but clearly there are problems. As a clinician, when I look at the statements such as chest radiography findings consistent with TB, it doesn't make sense to me. What does that mean? Yeah, so there are problems. And a lack of response to a trial of antibiotics. I'm going to come back to that later. So you can see that case definitions are very helpful to actually define what a condition is. But in diagnosis of clinical TB, I didn't find it helpful. And same with the HIV settings. I'm glad that people are taking out the antibiotic trial now, but they're still relying on the radiological abnormalities consistent with active TB. So you can see that even the case definitions are still heavily relying on the clinical and the radiological findings. But if you're a clinician working in a rural health center in Pakistan, I'm afraid that definition doesn't really help. Talking of smear-negative TB, a significant proportion of what is considered a smear-negative TB is actually smear-positive TB. And I can say that with backing with some evidence. Some of the work that we did in Pakistan, we found that actually 6.1% of patients who were given an AFB smear-negative title actually, when retested, were found to be smear-positive. So the retesting was done in a private reference lab. And we've talked about this yield of the second and the third smear, so I'm not going to go into that. Just highlighting the reliance on the clinical diagnosis, I think people are talking about the cutoffs. And the traditional cutoff used to be 3 weeks, and I think the evidence is accumulating that if you actually push the reduced threshold to 2 weeks, that increases the identification by nearly 46%. As I said previously, HIV patients are likely to have more atypical presentations, dry cough, for example, no hemoptysis, which complicates the matter first. And at the moment, there's no scoring system that I know of that for HIV patients, you can actually reliably diagnose smear-negative TB on the basis of purely clinical features. Radiological findings. We've done some work in low HIV settings where X-rays tend to be more characteristic. And what we did in our study is that we trained primary care physicians in some simple signs, simple radiological signs, and we actually found that primary care physicians were able to diagnose the majority of pulmonary TB cases on the basis of just 3 signs. If you teach them about presence of cavities, upper lobe infiltrates, and pleural effusion, they're actually quite good in diagnosing, picking up an abnormal chest X-ray in 92% of cases, and diagnosing TB in quite a high number of cases. But that's for low HIV setting. I'm afraid the situation is very different for high HIV settings, where the X-rays are less characteristic. I'm not going to use the word atypical, but less characteristic. And the usual findings in high HIV settings are X-rays with pulmonary infiltrates, with no cavities, low lobe involvement, intrathoracic lymphadenopathies. These patients in high HIV areas can also present with a normal chest X-ray and have a very poor prognosis. And unfortunately, the countries where there's high HIV prevalence, the access to X-rays is even more difficult. Antibiotic trial. I think in this conference, a lot of people have said that probably that is not such a good idea, and I will back that up. And again, another study in Pakistan that we did, we found that actually 2/3 of patients, once you've given them a course of antibiotics and asked them to come back in a week's time, do not come back, do not return. Whether they get better or what happens to them, I don't know, but they don't come back. And even the ones who came back, 6.8% of those were later diagnosed with TB despite showing an improvement. So you cannot really rely on improvement after a course of antibiotics to exclude TB. And this is confirmed in other studies done in sub-Saharan Africa, where the improvement rates among TB patients after an antibiotic treatment was even higher, up to 8 to 9%. And I believe that the most recent recommendations for diagnosing sphere-negative TB, which is currently in a draft form, are taking out the use of antibiotics in HIV, high HIV conditions. A brief slide on the trial of anti-tuberculosis drugs. Traditionally, we do not recommend diagnosing sphere-negative TB by giving a course of anti-tuberculosis drugs because many organisms causing chest infection are also sensitive to some of the ATTs. There was a recent paper in 2006. They uses expanded case definitions and objective criteria to assess improvement after ATT. But this quote, which Mark Perkins wrote in his editorial in the same journal, actually pitifies the whole situation. That if we are reduced to diagnosing TB after giving a course of anti-TB treatment for a couple of months, I think it's a pretty sad situation. And it just highlights that we've actually failed that microscopy to actually provide the answer. Algorithms. Algorithms have been in fashion for quite a long time, and WHO's algorithm has been around. International Standard of TB Care last year, I was glad, that acknowledged that most of the algorithms that have been around are not validated and they're not based on strong evidence. So they should not be used as a Bible, but should only be used as an approach which should be adopted to the local context. And I believe that there are new algorithms which have been developed and are going to be validated. This is a typical example of an algorithm. Now, algorithms are great because they do give a start, they give a systematic approach to the diagnostic process. But I do have some problems with algorithms. First of all, the algorithm mostly that have been shown in diagnosing TB, they've got too many steps. And from our experience, if there are more than one steps in the diagnosis of TB, patients find it very difficult to comply and come back for repeated tests again and again. Most of these algorithms are not validated and they're not based on strong evidence. But when they are actually printed as a WHO document endorsed by union or other organizations, sometimes the TB programs actually take them as kind of quite literal and as a Bible. As a clinician, on the other hand, I think sometimes they're not as helpful because they do not address the local context. And they're seen as top-down. they do not address the service issues. So the service is designed in one way, and the new algorithm is pushing doctors to behave in a certain way, and the service actually does not comply. The coordination issues between different parts of, between laboratories and between clinicians, that is not addressed by algorithms. And the integration of TB and other conditions are not part of health. So if you've got an algorithm to diagnose TB, well, that's not really helpful as a clinician. I want an algorithm that diagnoses somebody who's been coughing for 2 weeks or more than 2 weeks, not really TB. So, as I said, they're not specific enough. Sadly, TB programs at the local level are, they do not have the technical skills to adopt these to the local situations and apply them and then evaluate them and modify them. So what is the alternative? One of the things that, as my other job, I work in the National Health Service in UK, and one of the things that we moved on to, what we call is integrated clinical pathways. Now, integrated clinical pathways are quite interesting because they're local, and they're not just about the way doctors want to treat patients with TB. They're actually about doctors, nurses, and labs, and all other disciplines who are involved in the care of some patient. And they have got much more patient focus. They also look at the service, the way service is structured around a care, and they're not just looking at what specific clinical things needs to happen at a certain time. They actually focus on patients' journey and not just on specific conditions. So, as I said, it's about a patient who has who's been coughing for two or more than 2 weeks with HIV, for example, and not just TB. So a typical clinical pathway will have a timeline. It will have categories of care or activities. It will have outcome criteria, and it will map out the variants. So what are the conclusions? I think we all agree that smear-negative TB is important. It cannot be ignored, especially with high HIV countries where the morbidity is high and mortality is high. There's a lot more to be gained by improving microscopy service. As I said, a lot of smear-negative TB is actually not smear-negative TB, it's smear-positive TB, and we are just not diagnosing it. So there's a lot to be gained by improving microscopy service. I think we can develop algorithms and we can tweak them, but I think the real gain is going to come from improving microscopy services. A bit of contradiction to my topic, but that is the reality. Diagnostic yield can improve by reducing the threshold to 2 weeks of cough. And what we've shown is that in low HIV settings, using specific radiological criteria can improve diagnosis, and similar criteria need to be developed in high HIV settings, and their feasibility needs to be tested. I think antibiotic diagnostic trials are useless. And developing generic algorithms are useful, but I think there should be some local development of integrated pathways which have got a local flavor, which have got a service focus, which have got a patient focus. So we're not just developing an algorithm for patients with HIV, with TB. We are actually developing a pathway for patient with HIV who's been coughing for more than 2 weeks. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Siddiqui. If you can remain at the microphone, we might ask for some specific questions for you and then open up for general discussion. So are there any questions for Dr. Siddiqui?
Yes, Kate. Hi, Chris. Good to see you. Just a comment. It was very interesting and I think very nice to see at a lab session. And I think in my experience, I'm Kevin Fenley from New Jersey. In my experience, sometimes we clinicians are just as much or a major part of the problem as lab. I mean, it's easy, you know, when you're the clinician to say, oh, the darn lab, you know, their microscopy's terrible. Why don't they give us the stuff, you know, yada, yada. No, the lab people are sitting in there, you know, sweating away trying to get all these, you know, smears done. So I think sometimes we don't communicate very well. And it's been my experience that if the clinicians take an interest in what's going on in the laboratory and communicate what their needs are, you know, one example is when I was doing a consultation in Botswana, and we had this, I think, 21-year-old technician going around with us, and the whole purpose of this was on infection control. And we said, well, we really, you know, we should really get that first smear to find out if the patients are infectious, because patients would come in on a Thursday. You know, the smear would finally get into the lab on Friday. Nobody was there over the weekend. Monday, they get a 3 or 4 plus smear, and then the floor goes crazy because they've got a smear-positive patient, and they want to move them away from all the HIV-positive. So she said, oh, well, so why don't we just make the first smear stat? We can do that. We'll just move that. I mean, there are really simple solutions that come up if people, you know, communicate, and we're, you know, you can come up with easy solutions.
I couldn't agree with you more. Actually, some of the data that we presented yesterday, we found in a study in Bolivia and Peru that only a third of patients who were requested to have a smear actually eventually got a smear, which was useful for the next step in the algorithm. And the reason behind was that basically the way clinicians work and the way the laboratories work, they do not coordinate. So, yeah, 100% agree with that.
Thank you for your presentation. I have one question about specificity of X-ray. If you say, let's say you have 1,000 suspect TB cases, and among thousands, maybe 100 are smear positive, say are detected by smear positive, by sputum, that's fine. Then you remain with 900 potential smear negative cases, isn't it? And in fact, all these 900 are eligible for an X-ray, to find a smear negative X-ray, of which, let's say, 800 have no TB and the other 100 have TB, something like that. Now, you say to raise my specificity, you said, okay, you have a cavity, you scored with 3, a cavity and infiltrates and the upper lobe. But I thought that the most patients of that group, there are no cavities. If you have a cavity, they are already, let's say, taken out by your sputum examination. So the group you put your 800 of 900 X-rays, that is much more difficult. There are hardly cavities among that group. What is your opinion? How do you increase your specificity of that group? Because that is, to my opinion, the main problem here.
I agree. I think from our experience and work in Pakistan, what we trained the doctors initially was to identify what is an abnormal chest X-ray and what is a normal chest X-ray, and worked our specificity sensitivities around that. And once we were confident that they're able to do that, to differentiate between an abnormal and a normal chest X-ray, then we're saying, okay, if you see that this is an abnormal chest X-ray, then all you look for is those 3 signs, which is, you've just said, cavity, infiltrates. And everything else, you need to refer it to a chest physician. So the other leg of our pathway was to refer it to the district TB physician, because I don't think a general physician is there to learn everything that there is to learn about the radiology or the chest X-rays. What we focus on, that if you can just pick up these 3 signs, which were relatively simple, then that's fine. And if you can just differentiate between a normal and abnormal for X-ray, that's great. And once you've done that, then the rest you can actually refer to the TB physician. And we found that actually clinicians were relatively good, both in terms of sensitivity and specificity, in picking up between an abnormal and a normal X-ray. And then once you've got an abnormal X-ray, in picking up those 3 signs. But I must say that was for a low HIV setting. I'm sure that situation will be very different for a high HIV setting.
If we can just take one more question now and then open up for general discussion on the other aspects of improving microscopy. But please.
Mitch is in London. There is one way, in principle, of enormously improving the efficiency of cultures. And that is to use selective media so that you don't have to decontaminate, and if possible, to use primary inoculation into liquid media. And this has hardly been explored at all, and yet I think is one of the most promising routes to get positive diagnosis by culture very quickly. I mean, within matter, in most cases, of a few days. It's hardly been taken up at all. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you for the talk. I speak as a clinician, Peter Pickett from Australia. I'm just concerned about your clinical pathways and antibiotics. It's hard to imagine anyone coming to any clinic with a cough and not getting antibiotics. Now you're sort of saying, well, we shouldn't use antibiotics. You're saying we shouldn't use antibiotics to make a definition of tuberculosis, because I believe everyone will get antibiotics anyway.
I apologize for not clarifying that. It wasn't to treat chest infection. It was only as a diagnostic step in diagnosing TB. In my experience, most of the people who are coming for coughing for more than 2 weeks in a setting in somewhere like Pakistan, they would have already taken antibiotics either by general physicians or by themselves, where you can actually get over-the-counter antibiotics.
Okay, yes. Now, okay.
I have some comments for the first paper, bleach. I agree that bleach is a very good reagent for sedimenting sputum sample. But the problem is logistics. See, we can't rely on the quality of bleach available in any setting. And so to prepare these reagents and supply it to the peripheral microscopic centers is going to be a major problem. So otherwise, okay, you can, in a setting, you can do it. In a district level laboratory or state level laboratories, you can do it. My second question is, in the paper, the bleach smears and the direct smears were read separately in different laboratories. So that we have to consider before interpreting the results when you show that you have got the increased sensitivity. Maybe these direct smears and the bleach smears should have been read by the same readers and the slides should have been coded. And that's my comment.
The direct smear on the process smear was not read separately. We take the result and direct in a diagnostic center from the diagnostic center, and we also do in our lab direct smear and process smear. And when I say it is read separately, it is read by two technicians. And when there is discordance between the two results, the slide will be checked after. But not separately in two laboratories.
No. Even in the same, by the same the readers, the same slides, direct smears and the bleach smears should have been coded and given to the same readers.
Yeah,
that would have no...
The workload will be too high. Because for it is blinded. There is no number, but the when you have slides, you know that you have a direct smear or you have a process smear with bleach. But you cannot give, because with one sputum, you have four slides, two direct slides and two process slides, 10 by Zinnielsen, and you cannot give all this slide for one technician.
Okay, another thing regarding fluorescent microscopy. In fluorescent microscopy, minimum we see four typical bacilli to grade it as positive. So one, two, or three bacilli in a smear, we don't report it as positive. That should be these low-grade positives may be false positives, and most of them are culture negative.
Richard, would you like to comment on that?
I don't know. I want to just comment on, you know, Professor Branks. When you showed a slide where, you know, most of them, you know, were 1, 2, 3 bacilli positive by FM, fluorescent microscopy, and we don't really grade it as positive. If you eliminate that, 1, 2, 3, then most of them, whether it's a microscopy or fluorescent microscopy, becomes almost equal.
We didn't eliminate the, because we compare with culture. The comparison was
when
done with
culture.
When you
take these smears, the fluorescent microscopy yielding 1 or 2 or 3 bacilli, most of them are culture negative. They are not really viable organisms. Whereas when you report 4 and above, most of them are culture positive.
Well, please, just be very short. I'd like, Urban City, Germany, I'd like to comment, please allow a very old mycobacterium like myself, just to say that this discussion between laboratory people and clinical people, I've been registering at the meetings of the union from the times of Etienne Bernard. It's always there. Even Etienne Bernard went so far that he called it the rouge et noir problem. Rouge, that's us, acid fast, and noir, that's X-ray. And clinicians will always believe much more in X-ray, and laboratory people will always believe much more in acid fastness. So I think there is a dilemma which cannot be resolved, apparently.
Thank you.
Thanks. So, Kevin Fenling. Sorry, just wanted to mention in regards to the bleach, presented a poster yesterday. I think Professor had mentioned Ron Smithwick's work, and we had built on that, and basically Smithwick published a paper in 1981 that was quite elegant and showed using membrane filters you could increase sensitivity to 80% compared to about, I think, 67% on centrifuged specimens. So using smaller filters and combining it with the bleach method with light microscopy, we've got our sensitivity was 88% compared to 67% with a centrifuge fluorescent microscope. And we're in talking to people who are using bleach, it seems that we're seeing the same thing, that bleach seems to do something that enhances the ZN stain or, you know, Kenyon, and it really makes it quite nice to read. The texts were, you know, who are used to reading the old ZN stains were quite impressed once we started using bleach. So hopefully somebody who's smarter than us can figure out what bleach is doing to the cell wall of these things. But, you know, we may be able to do without expensive fluorescent microscopes or even the LEDs and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's heresy to some people, but it's a possibility.
John?
Maybe two things. There was also one thing to remind people, and there was an interesting poster yesterday, was that we've always made the assumption that bleach completely sterilizes sputum. So people sometimes are not just looking at sensitivity, it's for safety purposes. But we need more studies like the poster yesterday where, in fact, you still could isolate from culture specimens that have been exposed to bleach for long periods of time. So maybe we need something a little more systematic of how much you're actually reducing what is the percentage of sterilization and not assuming that it's complete. That was one comment. I'd also, I think Professor Mitchison mentioned about culture, and I think we do need to look at different liquid culture methods. We're looking mostly at the couple commercial ones, and are there other methods? One thing I want to point out, because we may all know that, but it doesn't seem to come up. We're always talking about how fast liquid culture is, but sometimes people don't differentiate. It's very fast if it's smear positive, but that's not the population we're looking at. It's much slower for the smear negative. And sometimes they're getting confused. They're saying we're getting isolation within 1 to 2 weeks. those are the smear positives very often, and the average is much longer for smear negatives. So it's just people need to recognize the difference whenever we discuss that.
If you'd like to respond?
Can I just add one point to what's just been said, which is rather important? And that is that the major reason for slow response in liquid culture medium is because the specimens have been decontaminated. That adds on anything from 10 days to a fortnight to the length of time for getting a positive. That's why I said you must actually investigate what happens with selective culture medium, where you don't need to decontaminate. And that's what speeds it up. I mean, for instance, a combination of liquid medium of microcolony, preferably detection, you will get very high levels of culture positivity very rapidly. Now, I say that I can't present you a series of studies, but this is looking at various other bits of evidence that there are about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Moses from Uganda, and I would like to comment on the quality assurance system for the microscopy. I totally agree that the word integrated quality assurance system sounds very good and attractive, but when for us like frontline micro workers, it's a very complicated idea, and I agree if we need to get together and work together, but if we want to try it, we need to be careful how we do it, because to develop a supervisory tool where you look at HIV, TB, parasites, chemistry, immunology in a lab is very difficult, especially with the limited resource we have of the human resource. Other than that, I would also agree that panel testing is easy to do, and however, it has its own disadvantages. Although you comment it would be easier where we don't have a strong intermediate network, I really don't see whether we'll ever strengthen the laboratory network without strengthening the intermediate level. I think we really don't have an option. We really have to strengthen that. People are talking about cultures, to increase cultures. We really don't have a way out. And then a short comment to Dr. Mann about alternative samples. I really think it's a good idea. But however, we'll never, I would request that we should never throw away this first spot because of missed opportunities. Usually our patients come very sick. To delay them to go and wait for the next morning, it can be difficult. But I think whatever algorithm we are trying to do, thing we should really consider the first spot. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, John.
I'd just like to respond on the integrated supervisory visit. I do think we really have to look at that. We said scarce resources. I know many countries had no visitation by a laboratory person. I think we've talked, can you at least get a person visit once a year? But I think we do have to, and of course, if you look at everything, you're not going to give the attention to TB that you'd want. But then the flip or the other side of that is, should there be a TB visit, an HIV visit, a malaria visit, and someone else? Do we have a TB visit and someone else looks at everything else, and can countries afford that? So it is a choice on that. And certainly you'll have less if it's an integrated visit, if it's looking at all the things, but then that's the other side. Do we look at the other testing at all? I think TB was one of the first in really pushing having supervising, because these are difficult choices. But also in many of the other industrialized countries, I'm not saying that that's the model, there is no TB-specific visit. You come and you look at everything. You look at the whole system. Maybe they're not giving enough attention to TB, but in fact, it is required, and you do have some supervision.
Thank you.
I'm Ruth from Zambia. I just to add on what John has said, this is from an experience in a poor resource setting, you find that we are crying about funds. Then you have the TB program has funds, the HIV program has funds, and these people will make two separate trips. So I think in integration, we should also consider having combined visits, because we are the ones crying about funds, but we still want to work separately.
We have any more questions for our speakers? If not, then I'd like you to join me in thanking all the speakers from this morning's session. I thought the presentations were excellent, and it's good to see such broad participation here this morning.